This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with Bernie Pinsonat, the longtime Louisiana pollster, about the election of 2014. We're 10 days away from the November 4th primary. We'll talk with Bernie about Mary Landrieu, Bill Cassidy, Rob Manus, and what's going on in the 6th District with Edwin Washington Edwards trying to return to Congress a half century after he first arrived. Also, Roy Bourgeois, the priest from Lutcher, who was kicked out of the Roman Catholic Church after what was termed to be an invalid ordination of a woman. He's in Louisiana, right here in our community, and we'll talk with Roy Bourgeois. And Felicia Harry and A.P. Turow Jr. on the annual Legends event at Louisiana State University. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and in studio is Bernie Pinsonat, the longtime Louisiana pollster and man about town. Last night he was in New Orleans at Politics with a Punch. I thought we might have a few punches yesterday at the 6th District Forum as Dan Clater and Garrett Graves got into it. Those two obviously don't like each other very much.
Well, if the news accounts are correct and you were there, obviously they do not. I think the Edwards being there probably saved today for the whole crew because he's such a good candidate. He's still quick. He's still sharp. Mm-hmm. And no matter what is said, he has a comeback, and I'm glad he's in the race. A lot of people don't feel that way, but Edwin Edwards is somebody that if you're looking at the political history of Louisiana, he's the most dominant person that's ever been in government in the state, and he's still very good at it.
One of the quickest and most humorous people to ever be on any campaign trail in any state, any nation. He is an amazing force of nature. And in the debate yesterday with the Leaders with Vision debate with Gene Armstrong holding court and a few times mistakenly calling Garrett Graves Garth Garrett, not to be confused with Brooks Graves, said, State Senator Dan Clater, whose mother had died just hours before the debate, questioned how an engineering firm run by John Graves, Garrett's father, procured so many government contracts. Garrett got upset, said he had nothing to do with any government contracts, and leave it to Edwin Edwards to say, well, I'm glad somebody from Louisiana got the contracts, and I wasn't in on the deal. So how does that race shape up?
I'm not involved in it. I'm paying a little attention to it, but I've been involved primarily from a media standpoint, more with the U.S. Senate race, spending all my time looking at that, looking at polls, and trying to figure out, as I talk about that race, make sure that I'm sort of on message or what's really going on. The fifth and sixth are jumbled up. I don't think any poll clearly shows anybody has any advantage at this point in time except Edwin and except Mayo, who's the mayor of Shreveport. He's African-American. He's going to do, a mayor of Monroe. The turnout by the Democrats will help he and Edwin, of course, and so they're both going to make the runoff. Who ends up in the runoff is still the $64 question.
64 or 64 million?
Well,
64,000. All right. Well, in the 6th district, it would appear that barring something unusual, Edwin Edwards will be in a runoff with a Republican. And there was a guest on this show last week who said that Edwards' path to victory is to get Lenar Whitney in the runoff, and that could happen.
Well, she has a base. In the Houma area, and that's where she's from. She's doing well. She was one of the early people to come out against Common Core. I think she has a Tea Party behind her. So she's a major candidate and she's a big player. How this thing will turn out next Tuesday night, though, it's just anybody's guess. Polls are a little jumpy right now. People are just mm-hmm. coming into their thought process of these races. So you're seeing polls starting to crystallize a little more, but they, for the last 2 or 3 months, you call people and ask them about these races, and they really didn't know that much about it. In fact, mm-hmm. Cassidy today still, you know, is not that well known across. He's known, his ads are running, mm-hmm. but he's still not that well known.
Mm-hmm. So I'm walking his dog this morning on Dalrymple Drive, and, you know, probably getting up early to be out on the campaign trail. In fact, I think he's campaigning with Herman Cain, of all people, today, who's also campaigning with Paul Dietzel. Herman Cain, remember him?
Yes.
Yeah. Not to be confused with Raising Cain's. This is Herman Cain, who is a talk show host, a prominent African-American Republican, and very popular among the Tea Party types.
Right.
And he's out there with Bill Cassidy today and with Paul Dietzel. And we'll see if Herman Cain packs a wallop in Louisiana. Now, at the debate yesterday, the candidates were asked about medicinal marijuana. And in the Senate debate, Mary Landrieu said she was against it. Bill Cassidy said he was for it. So this would, I think, show that Landrieu is the true conservative in the race, Bernie. And yesterday, all the candidates, every one of them said they were for it, except for Dan Clater, who said he was against it. So on that issue, it would appear that the true conservatives are Dan Clater and Mary Landrieu. Your thoughts?
What an analogy, and how did you come to that conclusion? Unfortunately, unfortunately for Mary, it's not about marijuana. It's about supporting Barack Obama. And I contend, and I've said it since day one, the issues really aren't that important in the Senate race. I'm not so sure about the 6th District because I haven't studied the issues or looked at any polls on it. So, but, you know, medical marijuana is one of those issues where I guess you got a certain number of people who understand it and think it is something that'll ease the pain, so they're for it. But marijuana in and of itself outside of that area is in Louisiana. It's probably half and half, but the people who are against it may or may not be that strong for it, against it. So it's really never been a big issue in Louisiana. The Sheriff's Association is really, you know, they come out against the strong.
And they've endorsed Landrieu, haven't they? I think they have.
Yes.
Okay. John West in New Roads writes, Cassidy has this thing and could even win in the first round with his stance on medicinal marijuana. It made Landrieu appear out of touch and causes friction between her and her base.
I'm sure the people who are for it, but that's not the issue that's going to decide this race for the majority of her supporters. Her supporters, you know, are going to send her back to Washington because she supports the Democrats. She's for the so-called big government programs. And there's about 40% of Louisiana that supports that. And that's her, the problem in Louisiana since we've become a red state, and she's around 40% right now. She's got to do better than that. Of course, she can. We still ways. But as far as issues, the only issue that matters right now, it's the same thing that applied with the Vitter race. It's do you want to send someone back who's going to continue to support Obama? You're going to send someone back who's going to oppose everything he has. And that's
Obama,
what this race is
boiling
down to. Obama
will only be there 2 more years, and then we may have President Jindal, and then based on Louisiana sentiments, we might want somebody who's opposed to President Jindal.
Well, that's certainly possible.
So really it's about 6-year term, and only 2 of those are Obama. So who comes after that? That's a factor too. And Mary Landrieu, I think, quite likely would be against many policies if a Republican wins, and Bill Cassidy would be against many if a Democrat wins again, if Hillary Clinton wins, or Jerry Brown, or some Democrat emerges as the successor to Barack Obama rather than Bobby Jindal.
Well, look, the winning formula in Louisiana has been for the last 30 years, and it is today. If the president's not popular and you happen to be in the same party, you keep your distance and you vote with him sparingly. Mm-hmm. Russell Long, John Breaux, Bennett Johnston, every time there was an unpopular Democratic president, they stayed away from him. When, for example, when Ronald Reagan was president, it was very easy for a Democrat senator or congressman in Louisiana to be popular, all you had to do was support Reagan, and you were gonna, you didn't have any opposition.
Who is more unpopular right now, based on your polling in Louisiana, President Obama or Governor Jindal?
Probably Obama, slightly.
Slightly.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, it could be. At one point in time, I did a survey and came out and said that actually Obama in the survey was 2 or 3 points more popular in Louisiana than Bobby Jindal. And that was when he was cutting, you know, that was when he was cutting hospitals.
297-5633 is your number for Bernie Pinsonette. Jim on airline. Hi, Jim. You're on WRKF.
How you doing, Jim? I know that I'm pretty sure that two words, President Jindal, was tongue-in-cheek, but I'd like you to wash your mouth out anyway.
Well, he could be president of the United States. He could be president of the Baton Rouge Rotary Club. He will be president of something, I'm sure. At the age of 43, there are a lot of mountains to climb for Governor Jindal, and he's got a lot of time to do it, and don't count him out. Jim, on airline.
All right, Doug. Dog catcher.
Well, he thinks this is a joke, but Bobby Jindal certainly doesn't think it's a joke. He's campaigning earnestly, and you don't do that unless you think you got a chance, unless you're an insane person.
Well, Jindal's now focused on the demographics of being president. I mean, look, he chose to be in national politics, so when you do that and you've got Obama president, you get attention nationally by attacking the president. Well, of course, that turns off the African-American voters in Louisiana and your lower-income white Democrats. So he starts out irritating about half the state. So he's not going to be popular in Louisiana when he's running for president. The first thing David Vitter said when he announced he was running is, I don't have any national ambitions. It has always been iffy at best for the governor of Louisiana to get involved in national politics, but going to Iowa, and if people remember, we have some people who've won there, Rick Santoni, you have
Santorum.
Santorum, that's right. Santorum, you have Jindal there, and somebody was talking about it last night. There are not a lot of Republicans in Iowa. It's not a Republican type state, although they're doing well now. But if you go in there and you have the religious right with you and you have the Tea Party types, which Jindal obviously has, it gives him some firepower to go in there and try to pull off an upset. Look, that race is a long way off, and people say, well, he's not popular here, he can't do it. Eventually not being popular in Louisiana may hurt him, but it's not going to hurt him in Iowa.
All right, here's another email from JW saying of Governor Jindal, as his hairline noticeably thins, it's gained a certain pizzazz and energy. The erratic growth trajectory of his new pompadour makes one wonder if those follicles were surgically implanted. Has our fearless leader become self-conscious on his Midwestern journeys in this land of tall, square-jawed, dry-skinned farmers of Northern European heritage?
I have no comment. I'm not going to get into that.
Well, he appears to be wearing lifts in his shoes, and he does have a stylish haircut, but I think that's part, appearance is part of it. There's no doubt that these days, with the television age as we have it, you pretty much have to be a good-looking person to be president of the United States.
Well, it's hard to run for the office and you're under 6 feet. I mean, it's an advantage. I tell people all the time, looks are very important in an election. Personal appearance. If you happen to be 6'2" and you have a lot of hair and you're a decent speaker, you got an advantage over your opponent, especially if you're.
But
a male.
Louisiana has not elected a governor over 6 feet tall since John McKithen, and we have the tallest capital in America. Shouldn't we have the tallest governor?
Well, I don't remember anybody in the race when Jindal ran that was over 6 feet, so I don't think the electorate had much of a choice.
Foster Campbell's probably pretty close.
Maybe 6 foot. Maybe.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. back with Bernie Pinsonet. We'll talk about the Senate election 10 days away from Landrieu, Cassidy, Manus, and others. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Bernie Pinsonet in studio. And we're talking about the U.S. Senate election, which he's been following closely. Mary Landrieu seeking a fourth term. The latest poll from Raycom has it 36 Landrieu, 32 Cassidy, 6 Manus, with a big undecided 23%. You think that's an accurate survey, Bernie?
It's within the range of most of the other surveys. That the I'm not so sure that the undecided that high. A lot of times when you're talking to people, when you have an undecided that high, as we get this close to a race, that means those people are talking to probably are not voting.
Not voting. It's almost a given that Landrieu and Cassidy will be in a runoff.
Yes.
Okay. So the real action will occur between November 4th and December 6th. Landrieu's been down this road once before in a December runoff with Susie Terrell, and she won that one, but that was 12 years ago. And there was a Republican president at that time, although a Republican president who was relatively popular in Louisiana. So how are the dynamics different now, if they are, than they were in 2002?
I think the quality of the candidate, the solidarity of the Republican Party. You had Foster come out and literally endorse Mary. He was very popular at that point in time. Susie Terrell had a hard time putting together all of the elements of the Republican Party. She struggled to get out of the gate, and whereas she did have a popular at that point in time, you had a popular president who was popular in Louisiana. Terrell never really put her campaign together, and I was really surprised she did as well as she did, because mm-hmm. she came out of the gate so poorly with so many people attacking her.
Well, a few months ago, and it has been a couple of months now, I ran into one Tony Perkins on 7th Street in Washington, D.C., and he is no fan of William Morgan Cassidy. In fact, he said, "Jim, moderates don't beat liberals. Cassidy's dead on arrival." Do you think Tony Perkins is right?
Well, he told us he was going to be the next United States Senator when he ran. How did that work out for him? So I'm not impressed with Tony Perkins' analysis of Louisiana when he ran mm-hmm. for the Senate. He certainly did poorly, finished poorly, and what he thinks or what he says is not a big deal
to
me.
He's a national figure, though, and he's a staunch Republican, and there are a lot of people who are in accord with his viewpoints. So I would think the fact that he believes, in fact, I'm looking at a quote right here. He says, "Cassidy has not closed the deal." They believe Cassidy is a suspect conservative because he supported Dukakis. He supported Obamacare when he was in the legislature. He has had this late in life conversion, and the man is 57 years old, and he made all these changes in his 50s. They don't believe him. That the people like Perkins, now others obviously do, but Cassidy, I think it's fair to say, has had a change of heart.
I remember Cassidy when he ran against William Daniels. I remember him in the Louisiana Senate. I mean, to say that he's not conservative.
He sponsored a bill almost identical to Obamacare when he was a senator.
Well, he was looking at Louisiana in our particular situation. There's a vast difference in that, in changing the entire structure of the insurance industry. Maybe it may turn out to be great, but it wasn't popular in Louisiana.
Well, he wrote letters to the editor attacking Ronald Reagan. Mary Landrieu's never done that. I think that Landrieu might be your conservative choice, Bernie.
Well, I beg to if you look at how he's voted since he's been a congressman, find me these votes where he's supporting the president.
Well,
and that's what this race, I'm going to go back, that's what this race is about.
Is he posturing to be a U.S. senator, or is he sincere in his late-in-life conversion to conservatism? That's the question, and Tony Perkins obviously does not believe that Cassidy is sincere, but others do.
Well, his statement that he can't close the deal, he needs to look in the mirror, because he and Manus are the reason he can't close the deal. One of the things that is very obvious to us pollsters and political and anyone else, but for Tony Perkins and Manus, the race would be over on Tuesday, a couple, you know, what, 8-9 days from now. Mm-hmm. So he's wrong about that, as he is about most things in politics. He sees things through a very narrow view of Louisiana. In Louisiana, you know, okay, he's got 12-13%. That's it. So it doesn't make him – he doesn't change the dynamics of an election. They're more apt to kill something, kill legislation or kill taxes. But as far as being somebody to elect someone, he couldn't do it for himself, much less anybody else.
He won a state legislative seat, and he got a big job in Washington.
Well, but that was a tailor-made district. There's a big difference in Louisiana versus, you know, North Baton Rouge.
Well, he was in a tough race. He was in a race in 2002 with Tony Perkins, Susie Terrell, and John Cooksey, all running from the right against Mary Landrieu. And who did Bill Cassidy support in that race and contribute money to? Mary Landrieu. Why didn't he support one of the Republicans? And he had three brands of conservatism to choose from, and he chose Mary Loretta Landrieu Snellings. Why? Just 12 years ago, when he was 45 years old. Well, that's why Tony Perkins doesn't believe he's sincere in his conservatism.
Well, here's the problem with that. If you're a Republican today and you go to Washington and you don't vote with Republicans, you come back home, you'll get beat. It doesn't matter. He doesn't have any choice unless he wants to be a one-term United States Senator. You can't do that today. If you make the switch to be a Republican or be a Democrat, you're in that sphere and you can't get out of it. If Mary Landrieu could have gotten out of it, I think she would have gotten out of it to a greater extent, because all of us kept saying, if you continue to support Obama, you're in trouble. Where is she? He can't go to Washington and vote with Barack Obama and come back here and think he's going to be reelected or get a good reception. He will not.
No.
It doesn't really matter.
I agree with you there. If he's elected, I think he will be an extremely conservative
voting
U.S. senator. Who knows what's in the man's heart, but I'm sure on many issues, Mary Landrieu is somewhat in variance with what's in her heart. My guess is that if in her heart she's for medicinal marijuana, but in a debate she's against it.
Look at the legislature on how many white Dems have changed to Republicans, and if you look at their voting record since they've been there, you have some that you could say are rhinos, but the vast majority, no matter what they were as a Democrat, they support they support Jindal because they're a Republican, their district's Republican, and if they want to get unelected, vote with a Democrat.
297-5633, a few more minutes with Bernie Pinsonet. So Katie asks, how do you see it, Bernie, in the primary coming in 10 days? Who runs first in the Senate race on November 4th?
Well, it's, you know, there's a big effort to get out the vote by both sides, and what bothers me about all this get-out-the-vote stuff is not looking at a big turnout. I think there's more excitement among what we call the hangers-on than there is the average person out there. Politics in general across the country, you know, a lot of people are turned off, but those that really care about it, you're going to see them vote. And what is that? About 45-50%. So the problem with Landrieu's approach right now is that she's doing obviously very well with African-American voters, but she's only getting about 20% of the whites, and she needs a lot more of those. So no matter what the turnout in the black community, except unless it doubles or triples, her problem is not the amount of blacks who vote for it. It is, can she get additional whites between now and...
All right, well, I would think she will run first in the primary. And if she doesn't run first, she's in huge trouble I'll make another prediction. Manus will endorse Bill Cassidy.
Gee.
I mean, there's almost no doubt.
Well, that's her problem in the runoff.
So she runs first, but let's say she runs first by 4 points. Last time when she ran first against Terrell, she was ahead by 19 points. How much of a cushion does she need to be competitive on December 6th?
Well, you make a good point. I've heard people say she always pulls it out at the end. Against Terrell, she had a huge lead. She had a 16-point lead against Kennedy. It was so huge that I made the statement that not even the nominee, Republican nominee's coattails are enough to bring Kennedy even close to her. So the National Republican Party pulled the plug on Kennedy, yet she only won by 4 points. What's different this time is that because of Obama, because of the National Democrats, whatever you want to say, in Louisiana, that's the majority of the whites in Louisiana, 80% of them right now are not in the, I guess you'd say, on the right side of the ledger for Democrats. It's the vast majority are voting, whether they, however they're registered right now. What's bad for Democrats is most whites, majority, are now voting for Republicans, no matter how they're registered.
All right. Well, on the day that Mary Landrieu defeated John Neely Kennedy, she received 988,298 votes. He got 867,177. She had 52.11. He had 45.72. So that's an advantage of for Senator Landrieu of 6.39 points over John Kennedy. On the same day that John McCain beat President Obama in this state by 18 points.
Right.
So on the same ballot. So I would think she did pretty well 6 years ago.
Yeah, she did. But if you talk to Kennedy, he's bitter because the National Republican Party pulled the plug on him with about a month to go. They quit sending money here and spent their money in other states. Look at the difference today with Cassidy.
Okay, so you're predicting a Cassidy victory?
Well, I'm not going to predict anything. I'm just saying the numbers right now. As I've been saying since day one, Mary's going to have a very tough re-election. The scenarios, most of the scenarios, don't really work out very well for her. But is she going to lose? I don't have any polling data that says that. All the polling data says she's obviously struggling to get re-elected. And if you look at the voters in Louisiana and how they've been voting for the last few years, you know, the second primary doesn't bode well for her because the Manus voters are not going to vote for her.
Well, thank you, Bernie, and hopefully we will talk with you again soon. Always enjoy getting your astute insights. We're joined now by Felicia Harry. She is with the AP Touro alumni group at LSU, a board member, and tonight is a big night for the group. It is the annual Legends event involving the prominent African-American chapter at Louisiana State University. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Felicia, we're joined, I think, by A.P. Touro Jr. Can you hear me,
yes,
sir?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. Good morning. How are you all?
Who was on this show a few years ago? Well, last year, I believe. 61.
I think it was last year,
yes,
Jim.
61 years since you were the first African-American undergraduate at Louisiana State University, and the story you told is one that resonates. It was not a pleasant time for you in 1953, was it?
No, it wasn't, but, you know, times have changed in many ways, good, bad, and indifferent, and we must pick up where we are and try to find the good people that can help us do the things that we need to do to live in a democratic, representative country, you know.
I saw Representative Pat Smith last night at an event, and she said that she grew up a few blocks from campus and could not even go on the campus when she was a young person, that she was kept out based on her skin color. And now, if you look at LSU, the student body is 11% African American. The football team, the great Fighting Tigers, will be playing Ole Miss tomorrow night. 80% of the team is African-American. There's still no black golden girls, but there has been progress at Louisiana State University.
Yeah, there's been progress in many areas in the Deep South. And, you know, in so many ways, the country has changed the demographics and the political persuasion and so forth. It's not just the South or this or that in terms of human rights. It's all of us involved in these things, and we need to be very vigilant about them. But groups like the NAACP, Black Alumni Chapter, I mean the AP Touro Black Alumni Chapter at LSU, you know, encouraging all kinds of people to be involved in activities and helping us maintain our history and recruit really good students. You know, you look at the athletic departments in many of these schools, and they're heavily black. If we recruited good students and faculty from diverse backgrounds, like we recruit athletes, we would have a better representation, you know, in these schools.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot more to do.
Well, the LSU Board of Supervisors is meeting today, and on that board, just one African-American and one female. Everybody else, all 16 right. other members are white males.
Right.
Is that reflective of the diversity of our state?
No, absolutely not. And it's not, and it's not healthy for anybody, because unless you're participating and sharing ideas and moving towards some common goals, you're going to still have the problems of ignorance, crime, poor education, disenfranchisement, and poverty. And we don't need to have that for anybody. You know, there's enough here for all of us to share and work together on. Sounds idealistic, but that's what I think the goal should be for everyone. You know?
Now, you graduated, Felicia, from Louisiana State University in 1970.
75 and 78.
All right. So how was it when you were there a couple of decades after AP?
Was different. I will say I share a similarity with Pat Smith in that I grew up very near to the campus, and it was always my father's dream that I would go to LSU because we could see the tower from our back door. So I was very pleased to be able to do that. I was in journalism school. There were a few African Americans, but the campus these days is very different in terms of diversity, which we really appreciate. But I agree with AP that we need to do a better job of recruiting students, not just athletes and faculty, so that we are more representative of the state and more students can have the opportunity that mm-hmm. I had.
What about the largely segregated Greek system at LSU?
Well,
is that an issue or is that a factor at all?
I think it's an issue for sure, and I think, but I don't think it's unique to LSU. I happen to work at another university in the state, and it is also an issue there. And that's been a long-standing social thing, you know, of do we go to an integrated school and find segregated organizations, or do we open everything? And I honestly think we need to open everything to get true advantage of diversity.
Well, tonight we'll be celebrating diversity in a way. It is the Black Alumni chapter, but obviously it is not an exclusive club. In fact, I remember a few years ago, and maybe it was last year, I was one of the masters of
2009.
Ceremony.
There yes, we go. So. Yes, it was last year we had our big reunion after we reorganized in 2009. Yes, and we're also partnering, I want to say, with the College of Human Sciences and Education at the university. This is an event that is free, open to the public, in conjunction with homecoming celebrations. We are honoring Mary Evelyn Bazile and Gideon T. Carter III for their contributions to the state, the community, the university. So they will be joining others who have been named LSU legends.
And tonight at 6 o'clock at Peabody Hall, 225 Peabody, there will be the Legends Forum, and you've got quite an array of people.
We have, the topic is Education Reform in Louisiana, Progress or Regress. And we have outstanding panelists, including Dr. Herman Brister from the East Baton Rouge Parish Schools, Gideon Carter, Dr. Kenneth Fasching Varner from LSU, Ron Johnson, East Baton Rouge Parish, Dr. Roland Mitchell, LSU School of Education, Darius Montgomery, Stanford Children, Louisiana, and Dr. Andrea Thomas Reynolds with Pearson, North America. And they're going to be talking about
all kinds of things, and we'll talk about that a bit more when we return.
I heard the music.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with A.P. Touro Jr., the first African-American undergraduate student at Louisiana State University, and Felicia Harry, who is on the board of directors of the A.P. Touro Alumni Association. And tonight, the Legends Forum, 225 Peabody Hall, right in the quadrangle at 6 o'clock. And A.P. Touro Jr., you commented that when you arrived at Louisiana State University in 1953, you were put in a dormitory, and things were not very pleasant in a big way. I think it's worth mentioning again the kind of discrimination you faced in your time.
Well, I was 17 years old and very involved in seeking to get a good education. I didn't go to LSU in 1953 to be a test case, although there were no black undergraduates. There were black graduate students there. And coming from New Orleans and coming from a proactive family and being in an environment where people were all struggling to make the world a better place and to rid ourselves of legal racial segregation, I felt that LSU, it was a time, was right for me to go there, and it was a good deal for the money. And I thought there would be a little dissension for a few days, but after that I would make friends and enjoy the resources of the school and get a good education. But that was not to happen, and I was totally isolated by the students, by the faculty. The legal procedures continued from the lawyers that represented LSU, and everybody wanted to make sure that the undergraduate schools in the state were not integrated, although the graduate schools in some of the state universities were, and my father had been involved in those legal battles since 1947. But I had a very bad time there, and it was very disappointing that no one reached out to try and say to me, look, you belong here, we can help you. The adults didn't do it, the students didn't do it, and the idea was if anybody had anything to do with me, they would be socially isolated and blackballed. So after 8 weeks, there was a mistrial. The case had to go back into a legal process, and I was asked to leave, which was good for me because I was doomed to failure there in that kind of environment. I transferred immediately to Xavier University, had a wonderful experience, and in my junior year, a lot of the Southern State Schools cases were bumped up to the Supreme Court, and we were all allowed to re-enter these schools and go back and integrate the undergraduate programs, which I did not do, but it paved the way for other students to come and go. It took 10 years before any formidable group of black students really could handle the situation, the social situation, and the isolation and segregation at LSU. But it's changed, you know, and it's been, as I say, I'm 78, almost 79 years old now, and, you know, it's a change university. There are new people there, there are new attitudes. We still have things to do, but it's a positive attitude, and you can get a good education there. And, what, 3 years ago, LSU honored me by giving me an honorary doctorate. So I did get it, although honorary degree. It was nice to see that people respected the time that I spent there and what I was trying to accomplish.
Well, and this comes on homecoming weekend as LSU gets ready to face Ole Miss. And Ole Miss is number 3 in the nation, 7-0 for the first time since 1962. And that was the year and the semester that James Meredith integrated the University of Mississippi at Oxford. Riots broke out. 2 people died. President Kennedy was forced to send in military police and the Army National Guard to quell the violent clash. And 52 years later, things have changed for the better. And tomorrow on the field of play, LSU and Ole Miss both will have rosters that are well over 80% African American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. And Mississippi has changed as well. Yet, unfortunately, as we look at the politics of today, as I say when I speak to people, there are lots of Mississippis north and south of the Mason-Dixon line today in terms of their political persuasion. So we have to be vigilant and try to cooperate with people and not allow laws to be rescinded that give human rights to all Americans.
All right, and Guy at LSU says there is a black golden girl, but I looked in the game program, there are 18 golden girls, and there are no blacks. There have been in the past, but you would think out of 18 golden girls, there could be one African-American girl who could dance well enough to be on the on the golden girl unit. All right. Well, thank you, Felicia, and thank you, A.P. Turow, Jr., and we will talk again soon, I'm sure.
Well, thank you, Jim. It was nice talking to you.
Take care. We're joined now by Father Roy Bourgeois, native of Luncher, who will be in this area, and we will talk about his appearance here. But he was dismissed from the Catholic Church after participating in what was termed an invalid ordination of a woman in a simulated mass in Lexington, Kentucky. Good morning, Father Bourgeois.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Nice to talk with you. Some believe you're a rabble-rouser.
Well, yes, indeed. I've got my critics and some well, the Catholic Church. The polls are showing, like the New York Times states, 74% of Catholics support the ordination of women. I'm in that category. But, no, I grew up in, you know, in Lutcher, and after I graduated from Louisiana State University in Lafayette into the military, went to Vietnam and felt that call to be a priest while serving in Vietnam. And I was a priest for 40 years with the Marinal Order, Missionary Order. I worked in Latin America, and I met devout Catholic women who said that God was also calling them to be priests, and what they said kept me awake at night. And the Catholic Church teaches that men and women are created equal. Galatians 3:28 says there's neither male nor female, we are one. And the big thing, though, as Catholic priests, Pope Francis and bishops, we all say that the call to be a priest comes from God. So the question I began to ask, who are we as men, to say that our call from God is authentic, but your call as women is not? And what I saw really is that sin of sexism, discrimination against women, treating women as lesser. And I grew up, of course, went to 12 years of segregated public schools, worshipped in the Catholic Church, where the last five pews were reserved for our black members. And I see some of the same language at work. You know, it's our tradition, the Catholic Church says. We're separate. You know, we have different roles, but we're equal. Well, not so. Racism, like sexism, like homophobia, is not the way of God. This is what we call a sin. And no matter how hard we may try to justify our discrimination against women, people of color, one's sexual orientation, in the end, it's never the way of our loving God who created everyone of equal worth and dignity.
Are you upset, Father Bourgeois, that you were given the boot by the Holy Roman Catholic Church?
Of course. I was a Catholic priest for 40 years. In my Marino community for 46 years. I was very happy and found a lot of meaning and hope as a priest. And I got such great love and support from my family, my elderly parents and my siblings, nieces and nephews in Lutcher, Louisiana. And so when I was expelled, I had never experienced that kind of pain, hurt, rejection before. But it's been very difficult, I must say. But it has given, I have no regrets, it's given me an insight, sort of a glimpse of what other people, you know, because of their race, because of their gender, because of their sexual orientation, what they have experienced in the Catholic Church and other churches and in society for centuries, what I'm going through, what I experienced in the way of rejection and pain and hurt. I mean, it's minor compared to what others have gone through for centuries, and it just has empowered me really to spend whatever days I have left, hopefully years, that I'm going to work for justice and equality. And I'm filled also with a lot of hope because I know that any movement that's rooted in love, justice, and equality, like the civil rights movement, the abolition of slavery, the right of women to vote, these movements were of God. And I do believe the whole issue of the ordination of women, this whole issue of marriage equality, this whole issue of accepting people for whoever they are because of their race, gender, or sexual orientation, this is of God. This cannot be stopped. This is rooted in justice and equality. And I'm filled with hope because I know that these movements are unstoppable. They are of the divine.
All right. Well, you have spent, you've been on the other side of the law so many times. I think 4 years total in federal prisons for so-called nonviolent protests, even got into a fracas with cops at the Vatican. You're not shy about getting in the middle of the action, are you?
Well, I've learned what many Cajuns have learned, many people in the South. I mean, when there's an injustice, silence is complicity. And a turning point for me was Vietnam. I think it was good preparation going through what I went through in Vietnam, wounded there, losing friends, a lot of suffering. But and then becoming a Catholic priest and working with the poor of Bolivia for 5 years, who really became my teachers. But they taught me very important lessons about trying to live out one's life rooted in conscience, you know, and integrity, to really break your silence when there's an injustice. And I must say, being a kind of a raging Cajun, that kind of part of the culture here. And I so anyways, no regrets. I've been in prison for what we call nonviolent protest. I've been arrested, of course, with women who nonviolently, I mean, you know, held signs at the Vatican, ordained women. Women are equal to men. And this is going to happen. I mean, if the Catholic Church does not change, it's going to go the way of the dinosaurs. So many, it ends.
All right, well, you may be right, but as a priest, you take vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience, and you have not been particularly obedient to your higher-ups at the Vatican.
I take issue with you. We are called to, as Acts says in the Bible, we are to be obedient to God. The Pope, bishops, priests, you know, they said we should not, I mean, there are priests who were suspended for going on the Selma March, for calling for integrated schools. They were expelled as priests. Why? Because they were disobeying their bishop. And you know, if I would have been speaking out back then for integration in the public schools in Louisiana, I would have been suspended because I was disobedient to my bishop. Well, the message is we are to be obedient to our all-loving God who created us all equal, no exceptions. And true, when we obey God and not men, many of whom are very corrupt, who are racist and sexist, homophobic, they are not men of God. And all I can say is, as Catholics, as people of faith, we are to follow our conscience, and we are to follow our God.
What do you think of Pope Francis?
I think he's wonderful. I think he's giving the Pope, the Church, some surreal signs of hope. And but we'll see. You know, words without action, as they say in the Bible, it's dead. And so we'll see. But he's making some real good statements about equality, but he's up against a lot of opposition in the Church. There are a lot of bishops, of course, and cardinals who do not want equality of races or do not see women as equals, but rather as lesser than they are. But I think Pope Francis hopefully will be able to bring the Church into the present out of the 15th century.
Mm-hmm. If you're on the right side of history, when will women be ordained as priests in the Catholic Church?
Well, they're being ordained now. They have said, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I encourage our listeners to go to a website, womensordination.org. Many, many women, hundreds of women in the United States and in Europe, are following their conscience and their call from God. Catholic bishops in Europe who will not identify themselves have ordained women priests and women bishops. So there is going on in the world, especially in the United States, a women's ordination movement. They have been waiting for a long time, and they feel they must follow their conscience and their call as men do. And the big issue, though, if the call to be a priest comes from God, who are we as men to say that our call is authentic, but your call as women is not? Who are we to reject God's call of women? It's equivalent to saying to blacks, I remember in my little town and then throughout the South in the state of Louisiana, we were saying this was our tradition, the segregated schools. The Catholic Church is saying this is our tradition, that we do not ordain women.
Now, in a December 3rd, 2012 editorial, the National Catholic Reporter stated the call to the priesthood is a gift from God and came out in support of Father Bourgeois and his campaign in support of women's ordination to the priesthood. Do you still receive the sacraments despite your...
I do. I've been expelled from the priesthood. Most Catholics realize that when you are a priest, you are a priest forever. some pope or some man cannot. When we take those sacred vows, that sacred vow is to God. Some man, including the pope, cannot dissolve your sacred vow.
All right.
Whether that's in a marriage or a priesthood. So anyways, the scripture says when you're a priest, thou art a priest forever. So I'm in good standing with God, not such in good standing with the Catholic Church.
Well, tonight, Father Bourgeois, I think you'll be in our midst. Is that correct? Father?
Yes, if you could announce where I'll be in Baton Rouge tomorrow for the Bienville.
Right. You're at Bienville House Center for Peace and Justice. He will be honored tomorrow, I think arriving later today. And he is the organization's 2014 Peacemaker Awardee. And in 2009, Father Bourgeois was nominated for the Nobel Prize. We thank you for joining us today, and we shall return Monday. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.